on New Comedy Radio, part three. Still Sabrina George talking to Dave Thompson. We've moved venues as the other one was a bit noisy, but still by the River Thames. So after the situation of the Teletubbies, did it change the way you did comedy, change your audience, change anything in your comedy world?
I suppose broadly speaking, no, because it's a totally different thing. When I do stand-up, I'm a bloke with a microphone telling jokes, the same as I was before and during, really. Sometimes it goes before me, and I'm introduced as a bloke who was in the Tinky Winky costume, or it gets a bit more publicity beforehand in local newspapers, much more so abroad than in Britain. But Robin Williams really hit the nail on the head when he said that being Robin Williams, if he goes and does a gig, you know, just turns up and does a gig in some small comedy club, being Robin Williams buys him 2 minutes. And after 2 minutes, if he's not funny, he's not funny, whether he's Robin Williams or not. And I don't think I could really put it any better than that.
Mm.
You know, that ultimately you live or you die by whether you're funny now. And what you've done makes no difference.
What's in front of you on stage, yeah. And because the other thing is, which I'm going to move into possibly murky sexual areas, but it's always fascinating, is the next thing that I think I was with you in a couple of them. I love them, Comic Discipline.
Oh, yes, yes. It's being revived in the form of Bugger Me this August.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
By the lovely Karen O.
Yes.
Because I really enjoy, I went to a few of them, and then cause she didn't really like taking women on the panel, as she called it, but we devised, I did two with her where I would gang up with her. She played the part of a dominatrix, and she does a panel show, and the comics usually get punished frequently and often in various dominatrix ways. And so we devised it that I would actually gang up with her against the boys, so I would stitch the boys up, and she found that. And I think she sort of said women are superior in her mind and boys are the lowly to be amused at a view. So how did that happen? Because you were quite regular with
her. Yeah, she phoned me up and she asked me to do it, and I quite liked it. And I always think that that if I sort of face the honest truth, I'm funnier in other situations than doing stand-up. I think possibly because I never really had a natural sense of rhythm, and I've never really learned a musical instrument. And I think doing stand-up comedy is like a form of music, and rhythm and timing is very important. And I don't naturally have timing and rhythm on that level. I might have it in terms of months and knowing when to go on holiday to an English holiday resort, but in terms of seconds, I don't particularly have that sense of rhythm, and I'm tone deaf as well.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so I think that's probably why, as a stand-up, I've never sort of soared to the heights of great fame and huge success. And I'm funnier visually or funnier in an ensemble situation. And so what I enjoyed about Comic Discipline was that it was a chance to be funny in a team, and to sometimes let it, I mean, Paul Foot and I used to complement each other very well. And we never, in all the time, we obviously were great friends in real life, but in the terms of the show, we'd always be arch enemies. But in all the times that I sort of insulted him and was aggressive to him within the fiction of the show, I never ever once referred to his homosexuality, which I was always very proud of.
Because just for those who don't know, Paul Foot is one of the tiniest, slimmest, blonde, camp, gay men who actually very little of his material refers to being gay, but he just is.
None of it.
He just is.
Yeah, we were discussing it the other day, actually, because we were on the same bill. And he never, anything that he says on stage, whilst it is obvious he's gay, he actually never alludes to being gay. And the material he does could be done by a heterosexual.
Yes.
It's just his presence is so gay.
His persona, yeah.
It was enjoyable playing with him, and sometimes, you know, easing off and letting him take the focus, and other times being able to sit back and take the focus myself. And I also enjoyed the fun, really. of doing it with all the fetishy things. And all the things which I liked about the show gradually got taken out of it. And she's actually doing the show again, but calling it Bug and Me, but cutting out the fetish thing, saying that she thinks that that's what put people off. But I personally, and I've said so to her, I disagree. I think that the fetish thing is getting more and more mainstream now and more accepted, and that's just the time to be doing it, not doing the same show but with all the smut and none of the fetish thing. I didn't really want to do it, but she offered to pay me money, and I looked in my diary and I saw that the four shows she was doing was four nights surrounded by lots of other nights and having stuff on, so I just thought, oh, it must be meant to be to do it.
She's doing it at the Edinburgh Festival?
No, she's doing it in some other festival, I think it is, in London. Doing
right.
The Etc. Theatre in London.
Okay. Yeah, because the thing I enjoy, it wasn't necessarily the fetish and it wasn't necessarily the rather naff innuendos. It was just the absurdity of these comics, and I'm really not quite sure what she was talking about, because some of us are not as into the fetish scene as she is. So when she'd say something about St Andrew's Cross, and I'd sit there and go, is that some place in Northern England?
That's more of a religious reference than a sexual reference.
Just completely clueless, and that sort of bewilderment and just having to make it into something and just work with it, and then her coming up with her random decisions about who should get punished and how that should all work. I thought it was a great idea. So Bugger Me is going to have a lot of the fetish taken out.
It's the same thing but with no fetish, no spanking.
Yeah, that is a shame. So how is she going to punish the acts?
I don't think she is.
Okay.
By having them on the show in the first place.
Right. Oh well. We're going to do our thing, whatever. So the next thing, which I don't really know much about, but you've written a book, or you've written a series of books, or?
Well, I've written a novel, which is about a stand-up comedian who gets a job in a furry costume in a TV show and then gets fired. And it's what I wanted to do was I wanted to include a lot of the things I've come across in my life in show business, whether it's to do with stand-up or to do with television or the Teletubbies. But rather than writing a sort of a kiss and tell, where obviously there are legal implications also in terms of one's integrity, because some of the most interesting things are people's secrets and you can't really betray them. I thought if I fictionalised it, put it into this book, a novel, then I could actually have all those sorts of things without any worries. And I actually have come from meeting a publisher earlier on who bought me a very nice lunch. But the upshot of the meeting was that she doesn't think the book's publishable in its current form.
So you have actually written it? It's not in the proposal stage?
It's been written for over 3 years, and it's taken me, 3.5 years to get to meeting a publisher. But there are two other novels in an unfinished state. But I've done a lot of writing stand-up for other comedians, which I prefer not to do because I'm writing to make them great. If I write a great one-liner and they sell it to some other comedian, I'm not going to get that much money for it. Even if I get £200 for it, it's not that much, really. And then they do it forever, and it makes them great. And after a while, they forget that they didn't write it.
It's not their own, yeah.
And other people will think it's their joke. And what's in it for me? Not much. Whereas if I write a brilliant one-liner and I do it, then people think I'm funny. So it's better to write good jokes for myself. I mean, I do make exceptions. I'm writing for two other stand-ups at the moment, stuff that could only be done by them, not by me. But the sort of role model I suppose I'd have would be someone, say, like Patrick Marber, where when Patrick Marber writes a play, everywhere it goes, the name, the biggest is, name is Patrick Marber's.
And sometimes it's bigger than the title of the play.
Yeah. And Patrick Marber writes to make Patrick Marber great, and he has lots of great actors playing in his plays, but he's like selling the material over and over again. He gets paid for the performance of it. And I came to the conclusion, having written for other stand-up comics, that the best way to write is to write something like a novel, which will then hopefully, you know, get published and then maybe get sold as a screenplay, so that it's my name attached to it, and that I get to take the rewards over and over again, rather than another comic who gave me £100 for the joke
20 years ago.
Yeah.
What's is the book that you've written? do you agree that it needs a different shape to it? Are you going to do that, or are you going to take it to another publisher?
Well, I think I have to accept that the publisher is a successful publisher who publishes lots of books, and that they know about publishing and I don't. Yeah. And I just accept that what they say is probably right. I mean, publishing has changed a lot with all this print on demand now. The goalposts have moved, because at one time it was a big deal to publish a book because of the cost of printing so many thousand copies. But nowadays they've got machines which can print a proper book one at a time, so that you can actually publish a book, and then when someone wants it, the cost is much less. And so the whole thing of publishing has changed. And then people are also talking about the book equivalent of an iPod, where it's an electronic thing and it gets downloaded, and then people look at the screen and the words roll past. And they already have them in Japan. People have books on their mobile phones. So the technology is changing the medium, as with everything else. And publishing is changing. And loads of great novels that we read now would never be published nowadays. In fact, as I was talking to the publisher, I had an idea for a comedy sketch where you've got William Shakespeare having a meeting with a publisher. And the publisher is saying to him, look, this play, William, is never going to get published. The reader doesn't know, or the audience doesn't know where they are. There's too much in it. You're crowding too much in it. And the very thing that would make a text great when we were studying it with an A-level or degree, the different
layers.
It's
now thrown out.
And all the motifs and the richness of it is now a legacy, a liability, because something has to be simple and clear so that people can understand it. So I disagree, but I'm willing to go with what she says, because she's an expert, not me.
You're going to watch it next week,
so you're going to rewrite it.
Yeah, I mean, I could sit there and defend my book to her, but it's not going to make any difference, is it? She's still not going to publish it.
So are you going to rewrite it, or are you going to try and find another publisher?
I think I shall rewrite it. Well, she asked to see another one I've been writing. She said she wanted to see that instead, because she says that the first novel often has too much personal information in it, so it's better to look at another novel. So she wants to look at my other novel and see whether that's worth having a go with. She said that she thought I had something, but that particular book she didn't feel would sell.
And then what would you like to do? Turn it into a show? That's the other thing I was going to ask you about is Edinburgh. Have you done, or any festivals, have you done a lot of one-man shows?
No, I'm not an Edinburgh sort of bloke.
Why?
I first went to Edinburgh when I was a theatre student at Dartford College of Arts. And the college had booked a slot in the Edinburgh Festival because Stephen Lowe, who was a famous playwright, was a writer in residence, and for some reason it wasn't going ahead, so they gave a slot to a friend of mine called Julie Oxendale, who now teaches scriptwriting at Los Angeles. She'd written a play, and we did this play as an assessment piece at Dartford, and everyone thought it was great, so we went up to Edinburgh and did it, and had an awful time because no one came to see it. A few people came, but not very many. Got a bad review, and even though we were just students, it was just a soul-destroying experience to be there and see all these other people who sold out shows, and hardly anyone was coming to ours. It was a play, so we had a big heavy set to get into, and we all ended up in debt at the end of the summer. And I remember the show was in the Masonic Lodge in Hill Street, and I remember standing in the sunshine, sort of about to go into this venue to perform this play every day that no one was coming to see. And I remember seeing along Hill Street in Edinburgh, at the end of the street there was a gap between the buildings, and you could see across the Firth of Forth, and there'd be the blue tidal waters of the Firth of Forth, with the green rolling hills beyond of Scotland above there, and the sun shining down on it. I just think, God, I would give anything to be out there in those beautiful hills or on that lovely sea, and not carrying heavy bits of scenery and setup
to an audience of two.
To perform a play to an audience of two. And every time I've ever gone to Edinburgh since, I have ended up remembering that, having the same sort of experience, and thinking, why? When are you going to learn your lesson? How many times do you have to touch that boiling hot iron and burn yourself before you learn not to touch the hot iron? And for me, unfortunately, on the whole, going to Edinburgh has been like touching a hot iron. I've got burned, I've been hurt, and I've had no pleasure from it. Apart from sometimes going up, maybe I was in a play when I was a professional actor once, and I was paid to go and perform in the play in Edinburgh, and our accommodation was paid for, and I was being
looked after. Yeah.
So that was okay, that wasn't so bad. But even then, the play got bad reviews. So unfortunately, I'm not the person to talk to about Edinburgh. And I made a point in the novel, which is basically about a stand-up comedian, of never ever mentioning not even the city of Edinburgh, let alone the festival. The Edinburgh Festival and the town of Edinburgh does not appear in the novel, and the villain in the novel is Scottish. It's no accident.
So doing a one-man show is not your thing, or just
I was
Edinburgh?
Invited to do one at the Manchester Comedy Festival this coming autumn, but I declined because I'm penciled to do a regular bit in a TV show, so that's why I didn't. Maybe I should try a one-man show. I've only ever done the one-man show, which was called The Milkworm, and it had the most hateful reviews ever written by anyone ever, in all worlds, in all universes, in all time warps. It was, one of the reviews was so bad, the reviewer phoned up to apologise and said that they did write some good things about the show, but the editor cut all the good comments out and left only the bad ones. So I would rather spend less money and go sailing in the Greek islands than go to Edinburgh Festival. But my dream scenario would be to write a novel that is successful, makes money, sell the screenplay rights, and then have a cameo role in the film. And then get commissioned to write another novel.
Did you see the film of Edinburgh?
No, I didn't even know there was one.
Yeah, I can't remember. It came out the year before last, and it was about Edinburgh and the experiences, and a lot of it, I identified a lot of the characters in it to who they were, and it was very... quite scathing again.
Really?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it was just, you came out thinking, why would anybody ever want to be in the festival? It was just.
Yeah. I mean, it's great that it
brutal.
Happens. You know, I mean, you could take me to Burma, where any artistic expression is banned and illegal, and, you know, I think, my God, this is great. All this creativity, all these people creating, is wonderful. But, I mean, I have been up there and had some good times when I'm just going up and doing a few gigs for a bit of money. But in terms of going with any big projects, I've never had a good time. And some of the best times I've had in Edinburgh is when on the day when there's no show, and I've driven over the Firth of Forth Bridge up to a rural bit and gone to one of those little small fishing villages and sat on the fishing harbour and looked at the sea and eaten fish and chips. You know, that was all that thing about all that intensity and people staying up till 4 a.m, taking coke and drinking and
stressing about their audience.
Not my scene.
There's one comic I went to, because I took the show up last year. And it wasn't very good, but I had the best time because I just thought, well, it isn't a very good show, so I'm just going to enjoy myself. And I did have a really nice time, but I arrived and the comic came up to me and he said, bloody, and he named some publication. He said, only gave me a 4-star review. Everybody else gave him 5-star reviews. He was sold out for the first 2 weeks of Edinburgh, and this was the beginning. And he was just white with fury and fear, and I thought, this is the best show you're probably ever going to do. Enjoy it. And you just see he couldn't. There's always another level to hit.
Well, it's a big game of musical chairs, and there's not enough chairs. There's too many bottoms and there's not enough chairs, except of course when you're talking about your auditorium where there are too many chairs
and not enough
and
bottoms.
Yeah, not enough bottoms. So no, I'm not it's not my choice. I'd like to say, oh yeah, Edinburgh, great. And some people go and they have a fantastic time and they've been discovered and got good reviews and have been approached by agents and all the rest of it. It's never happened to me.
Well, even those who do get discovered, they then add another level of stress in another direction, as the agent isn't good enough, or the, you know, like this guy, 1 4-star review, all the rest 5 stars. It's not good enough. And you're just like, it's a marathon.
Yeah,
it's a stamina game.
Yeah, no, you age faster. You know, it's free radicals, isn't it? Except they're not free. You have to pay a lot of money for them. And also, you know, like people who do well at Edinburgh, some people, they're perennials at Edinburgh. They do very well, but they don't do it very, very well anywhere else. And the big dream, of course, is to get your own TV series. But television is in freefall. So, you know, you're not even going to get your TV series, are you?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. Lots of Perrier winners have disappeared without trace.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which is the Oscar for comics, for those of you that don't know. What's the telly that you've got coming up?
Well, it's just I tend to be Harry Hill's stooge, and he's got a new series coming out on ITV1 this autumn, which is like TV Burt, but instead of limiting himself to reacting to what's been on telly, he's reacting to just what's happening anyway, because obviously it broadens his scope. It's going to be called Harry Hill's Hot News, and I did a small thing in the pilot, and he told that, I mean, as much as you know anything in telly, verbally he said that I was going to be doing it in every show in the series, which is going to be awesome.
And is that good? Are you going to enjoy
it's
that?
It's better than nothing, and I enjoy it. I love working with Harry, and I love touring with him, doing stuff in his live show, basically being a stooge. It's a job in show business.
Because didn't you break your back last year touring with him?
No, I didn't. No, I could.
You
could
hurt
have done.
Yourself.
I could have
something.
Done if I'd said. Basically, he wanted to ride me on, wearing a horse costume, and I said to him that this is too much. 5 nights a week of having to run, because it's the start of the show. Big, like huge flourishing finish beginning of the show. So you couldn't sort of come on gently. You had to come on with a bit of energy and pace. And whilst he's singing Rhinestone Cowboy, I said I can't carry on. It's doing my back in. And he said, well, okay, I'll get someone else then. He got someone else to do it, who permanently injured his back. Got
so
fired,
you were right.
And I was taken back on board, but not having to carry him on.
So where do you see yourself going with comedy in the next 5 years? Where would you like to be?
Well, I'll keep doing stand-up, and I'm continually improving as a stand-up. I'd say I'm about 30% funnier than I was a year ago, because I've been getting people to video me every performance, and I study the videos, and I've learned to give out less low-status body language. And it's like many things, one tiny... It's like driving a car. If you're driving a car down a motorway, you could be doing fine going down the central lane. One slight change in your position on the steering wheel, or how you're holding the steering wheel, you can go going off at 80 miles an hour and, you know, dying in a horrible smash. It's only a tiny adjustment to what you're doing on the steering wheel, but it makes a huge difference. It's the same as stand-up. Sometimes just a couple of tiny little weeny things are like the grain of sand jamming the camera. And I've sort of eliminating those, and been going down much better recently as a result of having studied myself on video. So I'll keep doing the stand-up.
And are you studying that on your own, or you've got someone else with you sort of looking at...
No, I just study it on my own. Mm. So
you know what you're looking for?
Yeah, well, I mean, I could just sort of see things which I think don't work, but obviously it'd be good to have a director. So I'll keep doing stand-up and enjoying doing that, especially if it's a foreign gig. Keep writing, and basically trying to keep working financially as an artist.
Fantastic. That's,
yeah, I mean, it probably isn't... You know, other people might say, oh, well, you know, I've got a TV show in development, or I'm doing a new one-man show, and that's booked in loads of theatres, and they're sort of like talking about staying in the £80,000 a year category. I'm thinking in terms of keeping to make, carrying on making a living. I mean, I've made a living out of show business for over 20 years, and I want to continue to make a living out of show business.
And you've generally stuck to things that you enjoy.
Yeah.
I mean, have you done much of selling your soul?
No, I don't really do any marketing. I should really pick the phone up and ask someone for gigs, but I don't. But out of show business, I've managed to buy a house near the sea in Brighton, which I paid the mortgage off on. And we're in the process of moving at the moment to a bungalow with a sea view in Shoreham-by-Sea. It's a bungalow with a loft conversion, so it's got like two bathrooms and stuff. And that's much bigger and more expensive, and I'm going to be buying that hopefully with no mortgage. So it's not like I have a huge mortgage to pay. So it's just really a matter of just keeping ticking over. And just carry on enjoying performing and having the lifestyle I enjoy.
Fantastic. Well done. Well, thanks a lot.